A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Afternoon Magazine, our call-in portion of the program over the next hour. We'll talk with George Pyle, the author of Raising Less Corn and More Hell. George Pyle, born in Kansas City, Missouri, has been a newspaper reporter and editor, radio talk show host, and television commentator in Kansas and Utah. He was a finalist, by the way, for the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 1998. He's now an editorial writer for the Salt Lake Tribune. He lives there in Salt Lake City with his wife and his two sons. Author of Raising Less Corn and More Hell, George Pyle joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Pyle. We appreciate you being along for the hour.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here.
I read the book, and it is a great historical look at agriculture over the last couple of decades, and to go a little bit farther back than that. If not cynical, like I might expect from a journalist. Tell me about it, if you could.
Well, I don't know about cynical. I'm trying to be realistic. It's a look back at the history of politics and the economics of agriculture, not the nuts and bolts of how you actually grow things. I'm no good at any of that. I wouldn't claim to be. But what I wanted to look at is, after being a long-time journalist in Kansas mostly and being expected to have opinions about the policy of agriculture, the economics of it, the government decisions, government policy, came to realize that I didn't really know very much about it, and it seemed to me that maybe nobody else did either, even people who were engaged in it on a daily basis, about the political aspects of it, that is. And so I decided to take a look at it and got some help from the Society of Professional Journalists and some others to take a look at it, and came to the conclusion over time that the direction that things were going in were not this just inevitable movement, but there was a result of decisions that were being made by government and by industry and by banks and others to try and industrialize a process that really by its nature isn't industrial. It's biological. And came to the conclusion that the direction things were moving in were not inevitable and were not a good idea. And we're not good for the farmers, and we're not good for the consumer.
When you started to take a look at this, take me back. What do you consider industrialized? And then compare that to the natural processes, I suppose, that you would like to see potentially on the farm. And I don't know whether that's the correct way to rephrase that question, but I think you get the gist of it.
Well, by industrialize, I mean the industrial model of maximizing output, and not only making it maximum output, but making it uniform, interchangeable parts, identical widgets all the way up and down the line, centrally controlled top-down management, that kind of thing that works for cars and computers and toothbrushes and things like that, but that I really don't think lends itself to an irreducibly biological process of turning sunshine into protein.
Tell me about the people that are involved in agriculture and how you view them.
Well, I think most of what the book is about is really not so much about farmers, and it was pointed out to me in an early draft of it by my editors that this is supposedly a book about farming, and there aren't very many farmers in it, certainly not individuals that you cite. But that's really not what the book is about, because farmers are about 2% of the American population now. They really don't have the political clout, the economic clout, to make the decisions. The decisions are made by politicians, and the decisions are made by large corporations. And so that's what I wrote about, is those players. The farmers, alike the consumers, are just sort of being taken along for the ride, if they think about it at all. And if they have any decisions to make, it's basically whether to participate in that or try and find some way out of that system.
Up front, you talk about agriculture as a whole and all of those sectors that are involved, including the journalist to some extent, and that they're all pulling in one direction, but you think it's awfully misguided on all parts.
But it did seem to me, before I started the research and as I was talking to people and as an editorial writer, trying to come up with editorials on a daily basis about everything from, you know, what pesticides should be released to whether we should embargo grain shipments to other countries and whether we should allow the continued corporate ownership of livestock. It just seemed to me that much of the discussion, much of the political discussion, and even much of what you heard from farmers who sometimes were in the long run being disadvantaged by a lot of this, was that this was just the inevitable process of get big or get out. This was just the inevitable industrialization of agriculture, just like the industrialization of steel and automobiles and everything else. And they're just it was assumed to be good because that's the direction we were moving in. And even if it wasn't good, well, that's the direction we were moving in, and there isn't anything you can do about it. Came to the conclusion that there isn't very much an individual farmer can do about it, but that there is quite a bit that a nation could choose to do about it if it would make different decisions, if it would not subsidize the program crops to the degree that they just basically beg for constant oversupplies, if they would pass or so much as enforce the antitrust laws that we have now that have encouraged this concentration of ownership and concentration of market power among just a handful of processors. We could make different decisions about those things and have a different outcome, and there's little to no threat that it would be an economic burden to anybody except maybe to the stockholders of the large corporations.
There may be some things that some of the listeners may not be familiar with. Tell me what a program crop is.
Program crops are generally those that have received since the New Deal federal subsidies, and generally they are wheat, corn, soybeans, rice, and cotton. Those are the ones that were grown in large supply, certainly all through the last century, tended to be in fast oversupply because they were relatively easy to grow. The science was put into new strains of seed and fertilizer and processes and things that would help you grow more and more of that per acre. Plus, they're also relatively easily stored, relatively easily shipped, as opposed to, say, fresh fruits and vegetables or milk or things that need to be refrigerated. And so they were the things that lent themselves to being in huge supply and oversupply. And so as far back as the New Deal, the idea was to try and reduce the supply by paying farmers to grow less or paying farmers to take land out of production and hopefully bring down the supply to the point where it would reach a market equilibrium with demand, and then farmers would be able to live off the market and not off the government. And that was the idea in 1933, and it just never seemed to reach that equilibrium because the more farmers knew that they'd be paid for growing those crops, the more they grew. And the more, even when they took land out of production, there'd be a new strain or a new fertilizer or a new irrigation system or even now into genetically modified seeds and crops. So even as the amount of land devoted to certain crops went down, output, gross output, continued to go up and up.
There are, 15, I think, maybe 17 program crops, including dry beans in the northern parts of the Midwest, North Dakota and South Dakota, plus the five that you mentioned. Any others that are worth talking about?
Those are the main things. Those are the ones that are in large amount have been program crops throughout, and then others have dealt with, like, say, peanuts have had certain quotas, and tobacco has had certain quotas that they've used. So it's a different approach. Sugar has been affected by limits on imports so as to keep foreign competition down, partly just as a way of being mean to Cuba, but also to protect American growers from any foreign competition.
You know, you're from Kansas in the Great Plains states. I wondered why you called this raising less corn and more hell and not attributing it to wheat, which is also a program crop.
Well, it's just such a good quote. It's from Mary Elizabeth Lease back in the Progressive era, back in the late 1800s, where she was encouraging farmers to change the way they did business. They were, even back then, they were growing more corn and wheat than the market could absorb, as a result undercutting themselves because they kept putting this glut of crop on the market, and therefore the price would go down. At the same time, they were having to do battle with the banks and the railroads and government and the decreasing number of people who would sell them seed and the decreasing number of people who would buy their harvested wheat or their fattened cattle. And so she was encouraging farmers at the time. She said, the quote is that that farmers should be raising less corn and more hell. Not only as a matter of economics to stop glutting the market, but also as a way of talking about how they spend their time and energies.
Well, let's start at the beginning of the book. And it's interesting, the first real chapter is titled Stalin's Revenge. Why?
Because Marshall Stalin in the Soviet Union was probably best known, at least to American audiences, as the guy who came up with collectivized agriculture, the guy who forced all of it into a top-down model of production, the idea being that that would be more efficient, that would be more productive, and that it would farmers wouldn't be left to wander in the wilderness on their own, maybe succeeding, maybe not. And at the same time, coming up with all kinds of cockamamie false genetic ideas as to the best way to get crops to, say, survive a harsh winter or something. A lot of it wrong. And if an individual farmer makes a wrong decision, he suffers. If a total nationwide top-down management makes a wrong decision, everybody suffers. And that was part of the reason why the Soviet Union couldn't feed itself, was that top-down centralized management. There was a lot of government programming and going on in the United States, but didn't have that kind of management that instructed farmers to do very foolish things. And so the American agriculture was more likely to thrive and produce and surpass the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War and become the example to the world as to how our independent agriculture was superior to their regimented agriculture. But in recent years, our agriculture has become more and more regimented, something that Marshall Stalin might recognize and Thomas Jefferson would not. It's not being done by the government. It's being done by the few corporations that have any control over what is grown, how it's grown, particularly who it's sold to. And in the case of particularly poultry, chickens, all being owned by a very few people and grown to specific specifications and done in a way that we refer to sort of as sharecropping 2.0.
And you do that because there are not that many firms that actually own or I suppose that they contract to own these animals, whether it's the livestock on a feedlot for beef or hogs in a confinement system or poultry in a confinement system?
Yes. In the case of poultry, the processors, the Tysons and the Pilgrim's Pride, they own the birds.
Correct.
From egg to shrink wrap, they own. And they contract with growers, mostly in the American South and Southeast, to take truckloads of them, raise them from chick size to slaughter weight, basically get paid for the amount of weight they add to the birds while they're in their care, not in their ownership, but in their care. And understandably enough, because the processors own the birds, they set down certain standards for how they'll be cared for, what they'll be fed, what kind of medicines they'll be given, how or not, who they'll buy that medicine and feed from, which is often from the processor with no other choice. The growers go into sometimes substantial debt to build the barns just the way the processors want them. But then after that last truckload of grown chickens is hauled off. If the processor doesn't want to send him another load of chicks, he doesn't have to. There's no commitment. There's no contract. And it's very easy to get yourself booted off of their good list by not providing what they wanted in the appropriate time, or by going around and trying to compare prices with other growers. I mean, there's no transparency in the market. There's absolutely no such thing as a spot market for chickens anymore. It's all controlled. And there's less and less of that in pork and beef. The processors don't own the animals to the extent that they do in poultry, but they do forward contract for those, as you mentioned, a date certain and a price certain per pound or per hundredweight, and there's no railhead, there's no stockyard, there's no auction barn in so many places. So it's a totally take it or leave it for the grower. They've got there's no free market in agriculture.
You make the case that this is in part a political problem because the U.S. government doesn't enforce laws that are already on the book.
Yeah, there's specifically something called the Packers and Stockyards Act, which comes out of the scandal of the early part of the last century, and when they were down to, I think it was six companies that had a controlling interest in beef production. Now there's four, basically, and nobody bothers to enforce that act. They just take it for granted that this vertical integration and industrialization of agriculture is good and inevitable, and even if it's demonstrably illegal, nobody wants to do anything about it because that's just not the way business is done anymore. There was a lawsuit, there was a federal lawsuit that was tried, I believe, in Alabama. The jury found for the individual growers against Tyson, and the judge threw out the verdict, and his reasoning basically was, it may be as illegal as all hell, but it's the way business is done these days, so that's the way it's done.
And then you also make a similar case on the grain side that there are only really four suppliers to producers for seeds.
There's basically what the economic theory is what's called four firm concentration. If more than half or even 40% of the market is controlled by as few as four companies, they don't have to get together in a smoke-filled room and set the prices. They basically set the prices, especially when you're dealing with agriculture where geography still matters. It's not like the internet where nobody cares where you are anymore. Geography still matters in agriculture because you have to grow these things, you have to ship them someplace. There are more and more, whether you're growing wheat or growing corn or raising cattle or raising hogs, there's so few buyers in the marketplace, and in your neck of the woods there's probably only one buyer in the marketplace that the buyer sets the price. And there's no sense in trying to find somebody else who might offer you a little bit more. They're just not there.
Let's go back and we'll continue our conversation a little bit about the grains. I want you to talk about the Green Revolution as you write about it in the book and Norman Borlaug and your thoughts and comparisons of him with Einstein.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was interesting because, I mean, Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Prize, not for chemistry or physics, but for peace because of his contribution to the Green Revolution to vastly increasing the output of
wheat,
and primarily wheat, and at a time, and the thinking continues to this day, that there's no such thing as too much food. I mean, the people who are engaged in biotechnology, if they can find the gene convinces us that there's no such thing as too much, they would be doing us a big favor. And through the Green Revolution and through the dependence on irrigation and pesticides and fertilizer that has come with that, basically glutted the market in particularly corn, wheat, and cotton, and maybe to a lesser extent in rice, to the point where farmers in Africa and the third world just can't compete. The combination of the scientific advances that grow more product and the American and European Union's huge subsidies that they pay to their farmers to keep them going and to keep them producing at maximum so as to feed this very cheap product into the processing system. is probably the worst thing that anybody's done to poor people in Africa and Asia in keeping them from feeding themselves instead of being dependent on the occasional rock concert that brings them a lot of money for a few months until the world's attention is shifted elsewhere.
I think the way you put it was that you figured that Borlaug maybe potentially saw himself potentially. You compared him to Einstein in this way, that Einstein came up with the process by which the atomic bomb was eventually developed, but didn't intend that, and certainly didn't like it, and notably said he didn't. Borlaug, I don't think you actually did. You talk to Borlaug about this?
No. I've read his writings and his Nobel lecture and other things that he's written. And from what I've read, he's still very much. He's not gone the Szilard or Einstein route of regretting what he's done.
That's correct. I've asked him that question, and I wondered about that. I had the opportunity to talk to him within the last decade for a couple of hours in St. Louis at one point.
Well, he's certainly a fascinating individual, and I would never question that he fully deserved the acclaim that he won and the Nobel Prize that he won. Yeah. I mean, certainly feeding the world is about as noble a goal as you can have, and it's certainly been used to encourage farmers to plant fence row to fence row and feed the world. I mean, it goes all the way back to World War One. You know, food will end the war. And the idea that you just produce more and produce more and produce more and everybody will be happy. But with the underlying economic factors, that the maximum production never seems to recognize, you can have all the food in the world, but if there are people out there who have no money, that food might as well not exist. Supply and demand governs everything, and if you have no money, then you don't count as demand. You're not there. And as you listen to, you know, a modern day, you listen to every Secretary of Agriculture, Republican or Democrat, for the last 30 years, and one of the things that they'll always say is that we're going to export our way. American farmers are going to export their way out of their problems. They're going to find new markets for their crops, and they'll export it, and that way there'll be the demand that'll sop up this huge supply. Well, the problem with that is that there are two kinds of countries in the world, those that produce their own food and those that need our food but have no money. They're broke. So either we underwrite it, the American taxpayer, or we give it to them, or often at the worst possible time when it undercuts the local price and leaves local farmers destitute, or they have to go without because it isn't convenient for us right now to bleed off our surplus.
George Pyle has joined us here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Raising Less Corn and More Hell. Listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can. The numbers to call are toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455, or WILL, or 333 locally, 9455, 333-9455. And we do have a listener on line one. Do you have a question for Mr. Pyle this afternoon?
Yeah, actually, I have a couple. But the last thing he said when he said that there were a couple of ways to deal with foreign agriculture or countries, put them in the two camps. Well, there is a third way, and that is that we could get investment placed in that other country so that they could earn dollars by selling us something, you know, so that they could earn the dollars to buy our agriculture. But, of course, that's fraught with a lot of problems. But I was wondering, my first question is, you said that our subsidies to farmers are distorting economics even across our borders and actually destroying agriculture in Africa and Asia. But why didn't you mention Latin America?
Oh, yes. Well, I should have. I mean, because especially with all the issues of immigration these days, I mean, I didn't raise this in the book because it wasn't quite the issue as I was writing it that it is now. But, I mean, the Minutemen are looking the wrong way. If they want to keep all this illegal immigration from coming into the United States, they ought to turn around and stop all that American corn from going into Mexico. That would be the best thing they could do, because an awful lot of that immigration is directly due to the fact that Mexican farmers can no longer profitably grow corn because their market is glutted by the combination of NAFTA, which means that they can't keep our corn out, and our subsidies, which means our corn is dumped on the world market at below the price of production, and they can't keep up with that. And so that has just had a horrible effect on the economy of Mexico, not just among the farmers, but it ripples throughout the whole economy. And that may be the single biggest cause of the push north.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of odd, too, that there were a lot of parallels in the way farmers were enticed into taking on huge debt only to lose their farms later. Talking about, like, the industrialization of farming. And how the IMF and the World Bank operated in Latin America for so many years, they would do the same thing to whole countries.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, in America, it was like back in, what was it, 72 with the Russian wheat deal, and everybody goes, oh, boy, you know, happy days are here again, and this will go on forever. So everybody buys more land, gets in bigger debt, and if the price of wheat had stayed as high as it was encouraged to do by one deal where we sold wheat to Russia, then, you know, everybody might have been happy. But, of course, Russia only could buy so much. This is also the same time when OPEC was getting active and the price of oil was going up, and people were saying, we'll trade you. It'll be a bushel of wheat for a barrel of oil. That'll fix them. But, of course, a bushel of wheat never cost anything near a barrel of oil and never will, partly because oil is controlled by a few governments, few countries where the government controls everything, and they can put a lid on production anytime they want to. Often they leak around that lid to make a little more money, but they still control it. And even though we have a lot fewer farmers than we used to, there are still enough of them that they don't get together and set the price, even though there are even some specific exemptions in American law that would allow them to do so and not run afoul of antitrust laws. They don't do it. And then the way the subsidies are set up, the way they're in debt, there's absolutely no incentive for any farmer to produce any less than his maximum potential output. If prices are high, you want to get all you can while prices are high. If prices are low, it doesn't do you any good to cut back on production and wait for prices to get high again, because you've got to make your land payment, you've got to make your mortgage payment, you've got to make your tractor payment, you've got to get whatever you can get out of the market. And you do that by maximizing production.
We have a couple more callers on the line, on the toll-free line, line four, a caller available to us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pyle.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting topic, and I'll be looking forward to getting your book. I live out in the country, and I have heard farmers say get big and or get out, and that's in fact what they did. Another aphorism or euphemism, I don't know how you say it, is if you control the food, you control the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if you are familiar with Ferdinand Lundberg's book, The Rich and the Super Rich.
No, I don't know that one.
It was written in 1968, and a lot of what you're talking about was pretty much laid out in almost an outline form in his work, and it appears to me that they're working towards some kind of end game. And to invoke the word conspiracy, have you uncovered any political motivations of what is their ultimate goal?
Well, I don't know that I see any conspiracies, I think the goal is just cheap food. The goal is to make sure that there's plenty of product coming out of farmers' fields all the time, just an absolute maximum, with no regard for how much it costs to produce, for the damage it may do to the environment, for the social and economic damage that it may do to farm communities. You just got to keep pumping it out. And the promise is that it'll be cheap to the consumer. The reality is that it's cheap to the processor, and certainly still affordable to American consumers. We do have the cheapest food in the world because of that maximum production. It would be cheaper still, probably, if we had competing processors and competing supermarket chains who had any incentive to keep the price low to attract our business.
So is that part of your solution to the problem? Do you have any insights on how we can correct this? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, basically, we need either more middlemen or no middlemen. We need either to enforce the antitrust laws so that you have more people out there who are bidding for the farmers' crops, bidding up the price at the farm gate, at the railhead, at the sale barn, so that the farmers get more for what they produce. And then you have more processors and you have more supermarkets who then have the incentive to keep the retail price low so that the farmers get more of the benefit of their work and the consumer gets more of the benefit of their work and the middlemen have to take less because there are more of them competing among themselves. The alternative to that is what's growing up in farmers' markets and subscription agriculture and things like that, where the farmer goes direct to the consumer without any of this stuff in between. And this is where you find all the up arrows in the USDA reports and ag censuses, is that where there is growth in a way of pursuing agriculture and where there is growth in income for farmers, it tends to be this direct-to-consumer kind of operation. And it doesn't help you too much if you're way out in western South Dakota and you don't have a population center nearby, but it's been very successful in areas around Austin, Texas, and Lawrence, Kansas, and Omaha, Nebraska, and Indianapolis and Chicago, where you have farmers and consumers who are physically close enough to deal directly with one another.
But you recognize that that's not a possibility for all farmers.
No, sir. No, it's not. But the more there was of it, the more that that happened, and the more that farmers were bold enough to do this, and the more that they had some reason to believe that there'd be a market for it and that there wouldn't be some processor come in and undercut them, which if the farmer and the consumer would make the decision, there'd be no role for the middleman and they wouldn't have to worry about them. The more you have of that, the better, and that's the direction very slowly that a lot of this is moving. It's not going to produce the amber waves of grain ton after ton after ton, but that the market will have a demand for that as well.
We have a listener patiently waiting on line one. Good afternoon to you. You have a question?
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks very much for a fascinating topic. I was wondering, and I missed part of the show, if your guest could just lay out in his sort of international overview, where he saw some of the sort of oppositional dimensions to this. I mean, there's the environmental movements, the human rights movements, these direct marketing groups. Does he see these as salient either now or later, you know, oppositions? So I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all intermingled. I mean, whether you're talking about human rights or you're talking about environmental concerns or you're talking about the economics of it, it's all intermingled, and you really can't separate them. People who are working for a fair deal for farmers, both in the United States and in the third world, understand that that's all interconnected, that rather than just shipping big tons of surplus corn and wheat to Africa or sending them money, it would make a lot more sense for us to reduce our production and certainly reduce our surpluses so that people were dumping on the market below the cost of production, give farmers in the third world a chance to make their own living. Presidents of African countries who are, you know, coming to the United Nations and begging for money to buy, say, medicine for their AIDS patients, I've made it very clear that if we would stop subsidizing cotton, they could sell cotton on the world market at a decent price, and they could buy their own drugs.
When you mention that, of course, I want to go back to the early 90s and the GATT Accord to begin with, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And you don't write about this exactly in your book, but the GATT Accord of the 1991 precipitated the 96 Farm Bill, which is Freedom to Farm, and you do talk about that a great deal, which decoupled, I suppose, the price support system from the commodity, and it was given a shot, but because of economic problems in Asia, was quickly taken back and converted again to the 2002 Farm Bill. How does that all work into international policies from your side of the book and distribution of food around the globe, as opposed to teaching producers or farmers how to raise crops locally in foreign nations?
Yeah. Well, Freedom to Farm, I mean, I used to talk to Pat Roberts, the senator from Kansas, and he was the author of that, and now he's gone on to relatively simple things like trying to solve world terrorism problems. But he would tell you that Freedom to Farm was not a failure. It was never fully tried because they did the part that decoupled production from certain crops so that you got these farmers were supposed to get that had been participating in these programs would get a phased out level of transition payments that would supposedly transition them away from subsidies and to the free market, so that they would take their cues from the market and they would choose what to plant, what variety to plant, and by what was being demanded in the market, not what was being supported by the government. Now, part of the reason that that didn't work was that just did happen to come along just about the time the Asian flu hit, and there was a big downturn in demand from Asia. But also, it was always dependent on the theory that exports would not only not shrink, they would grow, that people all over the world would start to buy our output, which was never going to happen, even if there hadn't been this Asian downturn, because so much of the world just doesn't have any money, and they're not going to have any money and unless we give it to them. And so the idea that we're going to export our way out of this has always just been a total pipe dream. He also had some ideas about changing the way they do crop insurance, and risk management, so that it actually paid for itself and that farmers would be buying insurance not only against weather problems and crop failure, but against market collapses. And that never came to be. There was going to be various sorts of research and development that never came to be. There was going to be tax changes that never came to be. Part of it was, the way he explained it, was he got this decoupling in, which was going to significantly reduce to the point of, in the not-too-distant future, even zeroing out these subsidy programs. And then when he came back with Parts 2, 3, and 4 that actually required the government to spend money on insurance or spend money on export support or spend money on research and development, other people in Congress said, well, hey, Pat, wait a minute. You said it wasn't going to cost us any more money. Well, he never said that, but that was what they'd chosen to hear when they voted for the first part. And it was in keeping with the growing demand on a worldwide basis that the United States and the European Union and Japan cut out all this subsidy business and stop subsidizing their growth and stop subsidizing their exports and actually have it all compete on a world market and a free market that would give other countries a chance, countries that couldn't afford to subsidize their farmers and subsidize their exports the way that rich ones do. And we keep saying we're going to do that, but the U.S. won't do it unless the EU does it first, and the EU won't do it unless the U.S. does it first. And all of them have too much political pressure from, they say they're farmers, but and that's more true in Europe than it is here. Here it's more pressure from the producers, who are the politically powerful ones, to keep it the way it is so that they can keep having these cheap surpluses.
And that, of course, is the policy issues as they surround the WTO. We have another listener on line two to join our conversation this afternoon. Good afternoon to you.
Yeah, I am to turn in a little late, but I got part of your conversation, and I think you alluded to this. But we're into this whole thing about corporations, and they're just getting larger and larger. And when you look at the pharmaceutical industry, when you look at the AT&Ts and all that, I mean, they're just getting down to a few. And so you got tremendous power, and this appears also in your industry in terms of the seed producers, the processors, and all that kind of stuff. So I guess the issue is that Congress isn't taking, I know it's special interest, so what's the solution there?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to get Congress to move. Jim Hightower says if God had wanted us to vote, he'd have given us candidates. But, I mean, the solution is enforcing antitrust laws. I mean, that was people understood that.
Well, we broke up AT&T one time, and, you know, Baby Bells, and it's really a joke. They all come back to each other, and then, you know, one of the smaller Baby Bells bought out a bunch of the others, and then they bought out AT&T. So, I mean, it just is sort of a joke that they think big and corporate is better, but it means that there's less competition, and what happens is there's more political influence.
Well, exactly, and that's what happens in agriculture. It happens everywhere else. What I'm trying to do with this book, and what I'm trying to do with when I talk to people, is to make the case that it doesn't have to be this way.
No, that's right. I mean, see, I think people are sometimes numb to the thing. You know, they really don't know the issues. People are working harder. They're working longer. The families, the middle class, is in. You know, paying more and making less, and a lot of them don't really know what the situation is. You know?
Well, when you're talking about telecommunications or you're talking about computers, I think you can make a better case for monopoly or oligopoly there. You can make the argument that it becomes efficient, that the price can go down because of innovation and things like that, as opposed to the old way of keeping prices down, which was competition. But I don't think you can make that case in agriculture at all. I don't think you can make the case that we need to have a few giant corporations, and we need to have tons of fertilizer and tons of pesticide, and we need to have all this stuff, or else we'll run short of food. I mean, that's the way it's put to us. We have to accept these changes or run the risk of running short of food, or if not running short, then it being a lot more expensive. And I just, you know, absent some huge epidemic, which actually is more likely to occur in an industrial model than it is in an independent model, because in an industrial model you have genetic uniformity, you have all these kinds of things that if you get the right kind of bug, then, boy, it's all you can eat night for the bacteria. Or if you have independent farmers that have different strains of grain and different breeds of cattle that fit their style and fit their climate and fit their soil, you're much less likely to have a catastrophe of Soviet proportions, because you have the biological diversity, the diversity that nature demands. I mean, they say nature abhors a vacuum. Nature abhors uniformity. I mean, you look around the world, and the planet is just lousy with life, and nobody has to plant it, and nobody has to weed it, and nobody has to fertilize it, because it is diverse and it fits its ecological niche and it all supports each other in the way that it is grown up to support it. And the industrialization of agriculture flies in the face of that. It tries to make everything genetically the same, which nature doesn't go for and will have its revenge on eventually. It tries to make everything, you know, it wants all the eggs to be the same size. It wants all the cattle to be the same weight and the same fat content. It wants all the pigs to be exactly the same so that they can process them better. And so the economic pressures are on the farmers to do that, although there are enough of them more and more. Again, it almost only works if you're relatively near a population center or you've got some deal with a restaurant or a market or something. But more and more they're starting to understand that if you really want to make a living farming and you don't have to work that other job in town, which more and more of them do, you need to find a niche, you need to find a market, a restaurant, a co-op, a farmer's market that you can sell to. Unfortunately, it works a lot better. In Kansas there was what they call the land-to-hand alliance, where they would deal directly with relatively large-scale buyers, schools, prisons, hospitals, restaurants. And the place they always started and the place they always had the most initial success was in senior centers or in places where they'd get senior citizens would get together for lunch, because the older people remembered what a tomato was supposed to taste like, and they didn't expect to have certain vegetables 365 days a year. They understood what seasons were. So they were much more amenable to the idea of local produce on a local schedule in keeping with the local seasons, as opposed to expecting, you know, to have strawberries all year long. But more and more people are starting to understand, you know, the importance of it being nutritional and free of various pesticides and certain genetic peculiarities. And so there is growth in that, but it's not all by itself the magic bullet that's going to take care of everything, absent some changes in federal policy.
You brought up genetic diversity, and I made note of this in your book, that you talk about having hundreds of different varieties of corn and soybeans and such, and that biotech was really limiting that. Factually, that's not right, I don't think. Let me go back just a bit, because I am one of those farm broadcasters that you talk about at the beginning of the book. It seems to me, and I called you this a cynical view of the history of ag in some respects, because all journalists are cynical and so am I. So I thought that was a camaraderie
sure.
thing.
That was sure.
But factually, if you look back.